Welcome to the Rock and Roll Research Podcast, where we share the super cool backstories and side gigs of the research and insights pros that you trust. Well, you know, if Buddy Holly were alive today, he'd be singing about the rare patient voice proposal automation module. I'm almost sure of it. But so says today's guest, before treating YouTube viewers to a rousing rendition of Buddy Holly's classic, Oh Boy. Except that he's changed the lyrics to be all about said proposal automation module. So really fun stuff. I'm joined today by Wes Michael, who founded the company Rare Patient Voice back in 2013 after a very successful insights career on the supplier and the client side, started on the client side. His is often the only company that can fulfill some of these research studies where you're looking for patients and caregivers with rare and orphan diseases. So they do a very good job at that. We're going to talk about all that and more on today's podcast. Welcome to the show, Wes.
All right. Great to be here, Matt.
Yeah. Super happy to have you. Very happy to have you. So I love these videos. We're going to talk about them in a second, but let's talk about your career. Let's take us all the way back. How did you get into insights? What caused you to form Rare Patient Voice? Tell us a little about your journey.
Sure. So I was an English major. I didn't know anything about any, I didn't know how to spell. Well, I probably knew how to spell research, but that's about it. and my first job out of college, I was working for this guy that had a small computer consulting business. I knew nothing about computers either, but I had taken one course in programming that I never did. But he started doing these surveys. He had these publications and he would do these surveys asking people to rate their software program or their small business computer, whatever it might be. And I didn't know anything about it. I started tabulating them by hand, you know, the calculator. Yeah. And I would write about it. And I thought it was kind of interesting. But then I went to graduate school and actually learned about statistics because I didn't know anything about that. Statistics, yeah. And marketing and market research. And I thought it was pretty cool stuff. And I went to, that's where I went to General Mills, which is a great training ground. In Minneapolis, cold though it may be, they really learn a lot about the consumer research, how to get into people's heads and how to apply it. And I worked there for a few cold winters. And
just curious, you know, because I'm from St. Paul originally. I'm curious to know which categories you were working on back then, or which brands.
Yeah, I started in this kind of as an all other group. They, at that time, they owned Gorton's Frozen Fish, the Gorton's Fishermen and from Gloucester, Mass. And I worked on that. And then I was in what they call the Big G division, the cereal. So yeah. Wheaties and Total and Cheerios.
Yeah.
So pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, the good stuff. Excellent. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
Then I moved to McCormick in Maryland, the spice company. Yeah. From a big company to a much smaller research group, a bigger fish in a smaller pond. Yeah. And enjoyed that. And spices and seasonings and new products and things like that and research. And then moved into the brand. I was a brand manager of the Gourmet Spices and Produce Partners. And I killed off a lot of brands. They gave me an award, the Dr. Kevorkian of brands, because they would buy these things, you know, just to kill them. So that was my job. So, you know, you do what you can. So I was there for a dozen years. And Then I was looking for something a little different, and I was very much interested in getting back into market research. And I knew nothing about pharma or healthcare, that kind of thing, but I was talking to a headhunter, and those, you remember headhunters, they used to call you up and try to have you switch jobs.
Yeah, and, it happens once in a while.
It still happens now that it's all LinkedIn, right? But they talked about this firm, Miglior Kaplan, that was local, and that was great. I said, let me work locally if all possible. And they did healthcare research, and everybody, this was in the late 90s, they just made legal those DTC, direct-to-consumer ads you see on TV for the drugs. Before that, it was not.
Oh, yeah, fascinating time.
So it was a great time the healthcare space was looking for people who knew consumer marketing and research.
To
the pharma world. So that was a cool thing to go there. All these really smart people from the Pfizers and BMSs and Mercks and such that knew everything about getting a sales rep in front of a doc and how to convince them to write more prescriptions, but nothing. They never heard of a GRP. What's TV? What do we do? So it was a really interesting thing. Well, one of our first clients said, hey, can you build a panel hemophilia patients. It's very rare. There's only a couple thousand in the country. Mm-hmm. Patients and caregivers. We have a product, a treatment for them. It's the same as the competitors. So we need to market. We need to find out what's in their heads. How can we go to them and their families? And you know, we as a lot of vendors, we bid on it, won it, and then we had to figure out how to do it.
Right.
And so we went to the National Hemophilia Conference, set up our table, had our giveaways. It's all paper and pencil. People signed, and it worked. People signed up. We put it through the National Family Opinion folks.
The NFO panel.
And it was very good. We did lots of work for that client, surveys and interviews. Every year we'd go back and recruit more folks. Well, 2 or 3 years later, I was back at the National Hemophilia Conference, and a different client came up to me and said, "We hear you have this patient panel. Can we access it?" We're like, "Well, no, you know, client A pays for it. You can't hand it over to client B." But that's the idea for rare patient. It gave me that. It's like, wait a minute, why not create a panel that's not just for one client?
Right.
But that was roughly 2000. So it still took me 13 years to finally act on that. But I had that idea. I would refer to it from time to time. I tell my wife, she didn't know what I was talking about, but I said, I think there's something there. And everything came together for me in 2013 because I was working for a smaller research company at that point that was running, had some cash flow issues. And my wife had been out of the workforce for a dozen years raising our kids, and she was looking for a job. Well, she found one and it had healthcare. And I said, look, if I'm not going to be paid for a few months, I've got this idea. Let me start this thing. So I spent the summer, you know, okay, let's get a name and let's do it. Guess what? First thing I did, went to the hemophilia conference, right? Yeah. I'm not stupid. It worked before, right? It'll work again.
Absolutely.
And our first project was a hemophilia recruit. And that was the beginning in 2013. And now we've done 9,500 projects. We've got over 100,000 folks in the US. Now we've got 30 or 40,000 in Europe. We paid patients over $13 million. So, you know, we pay them, we don't just give them some points. We pay them $120 an hour. So,
wow, that's really impressive.
Yeah, and you know, nobody blinks at that. You know, that's nothing in a study, right? So you need these rare folks, and we might as well honor these people. So anyway, we've done that. And then we build our team up so that I do like to go to some patient events, but we have other people that go there and recruit patients, people that run the projects, do a wonderful job, people that write the proposals. I'm kind of reduced to coming on podcasts and doing LinkedIn songs,
So I have one question about the panel recruit, because it seems to me that it's got to be really interesting, creative work to think about how can we find these people, right? And so that's sort of an expertise you build up over time. I'm just kind of guessing, outside looking in, being faced with opportunities in this business where it's like, oh, can we build a panel of such and such? Sometimes it sounds easy, but once you get to it, it's very difficult.
Yeah. I mean, that first thing about going to the conference was the key thing. Cause I said, well, there's very few of these people. Like if you had a big panel of 1 million people, you'd only have like 3 with hemophilia. So it's not a matter of just getting a lot. You have to go to where they are. So the first thing, even when it's just me, I would go to MS walks, you know, there's walks to raise money.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
I'd go to all kinds of walks and conferences and things like that. And that was great. But then I thought, well, I can't go everywhere, you know, and if I just go to Albuquerque and Chicago and Baltimore for an MS walk, people might want patients in other places.
Right.
But it solved itself. I remember I was in Albuquerque, and this was fun because, you know, a walk might be a Saturday or Sunday morning. So I got two kids, and one of them would go with me each time, and we do tourist things the rest of the weekend. And I'd fly on my few Southwest points, and we went to Albuquerque. I remember my daughter went to Albuquerque, and we had a good time. But the Saturday morning, we were at the walk and recruited folks. But at that very walk, somebody came up to me, because we signed up a lot of people, but somebody came up and she says, I get this. She goes, I know a lot of people. Well, she started spreading the word. And they weren't just in Albuquerque. They were all over the country because people, you know, people are on Facebook. People are so connected. And then I said, okay, hey, this is how we fill in the gaps. And then I got smart and said, hey, why don't we reward people for referrals? And so we have a referral program. And so now, and then when COVID hit, good thing, because the in-person events were shut down. But now we have a wonderful referral program where we pay folks, advocacy groups, individuals. We pay them $10 we give them their own link so we can give them credit and people sign up. And we vet them. And if they do that, they get $10 up. It's like a passive fundraiser for a lot of these folks.
Yeah.
So when I first did it, I'm like, you know, anybody could do this. And I remember talking to, I don't know, Tony Burke, who ran the patient panels at a con. And I said, Tony, you guys could do it. He says, we don't want to send people out on weekends to go to these events. We'll just subcontract to you. And it's like, that's the answer I wanted to hear.
Yeah.
It wasn't big enough for these big guys to get involved.
Right.
But it was bigger than most people thought. There's a lot of work, a lot of patient work, not as much as there is in physicians, but all those physician panel companies, you know, have to fight each other out. There wasn't a lot of, you know, fighting in the patient world.
Yeah, yeah, sure. And I suppose it's one of those things too, where any given condition is extremely rare, but if you're talking hundreds, thousands of conditions, you know, a lot of people have some condition that's quite rare. So
that's right. That's right. Each one is rare, but 10% or more people have a rare disease. And then the other thing, which is unfortunate, but fortunate in a way for us, is most people don't have one condition.
Right.
Yep. You have multiple conditions. So that's where we expanded outside of rare. Even the focus is on rare. People say, well, should I also put my asthma down? And I'm like, I don't know. And then a client would say, I happen to have asthma patients. Okay. We're not going to say no to anybody.
Sure.
And with autoimmune conditions, they travel together. People have a lot. And I say, it's unfortunately you have all those, but list them all. You'll have more opportunities to take part in research.
Yeah.
The silver lining.
That's great. All right. So you've got Buddy Holly, you've got Dolly Parton, you've got others. How did you stumble on this idea to create these nutty little jingles about some of your product releases and different news about the company? It's really fun.
Yeah. You know, I was one of those guys that they would always call on me when somebody had a retirement party or a, you know, holiday, whatever, to do a silly song, you know. And you take a song.
You're the silly song guy.
Yeah, I'm the silly song guy. It's like, don't ask me why. And then at some point, you know, we started doing more LinkedIn, and LinkedIn has been very, very, it's a perfect fit with our business. But and somehow I said, well, I'm allowed to do whatever I want now. I can do this. And I started it, and people say, oh, I saw that. I did. So it was, I said, I'm not afraid to embarrass myself to promote the company, right? So,
yeah.
Sometimes I've done a lot, I haven't done a lot lately. I did one not too long ago, but whenever I get inspired, I go, wait a minute. Either a song, I hear a song and want to do something with it, or I have an idea and say, what song would work with that?
Yeah.
And I just do it, and it's good or it's bad, but in any event, people laugh and have fun with it.
And you know, I just have to say, it's, I pay attention a lot more to, for example, your proposal automation module than I would if it was just some dumb, boring video about a proposal automation module. So it works.
I know,
capture my attention for sure.
Yeah. So it's been fun. Get the word out and have people remember us.
Yeah. Cool. So hey, check out the YouTube for Rare Patient Voice. There's a lot of good stuff there. Cool. So have you noticed do you find that those videos perform better or anything like that? Is it any impact on your business, or is it just like the getting your internal silly song guy out there?
It's hard to tie anything back to any one post, because some of them will get it. So there's all these algorithms people talk about on LinkedIn, and sometimes they don't want you to leave it. So if you click on a song, it takes you to YouTube. It may actually hurt your LinkedIn. So I don't know about that, but I do know, like, we'll go to a conference and people say, oh, I saw that. I see you. The funniest time, I was at a conference once and talking to somebody, and some woman said, out of the blue, I hear that voice. Wes, I follow you. I'm like, I have a groupie.
You got one out there. Cool.
So it gets the word out. And then people, I say it's like tire ads, right? How often do you need your tires? But when you do, you're like, wait a minute, is it Michelin safe? Didn't I hear something about Michelin being safe? It's like, when a lot of people's like, they might not need patients or rare patients, but when they do, they're like, wait a minute, what's that company that has them? What's that rare patient company? Hey, get the word out there. And then you kind of hit the nail on the head too. Some of it's just me having a little fun. It's like, hey, nobody can stop me from doing this. And
no one can shut down your YouTube page. So
I can try, but
believe me, I can appreciate that totally. So all right, so you have it's very interesting because you started your career in consumer goods, right? And then you found your way into pharma. And you, in some ways you could say, went real old school by, you know, going face to face and going to mess walks and going to conferences to be able to build up your asset. So kind of reflecting on where you've been and what you see going forward, what do you see in the future of insights?
You know, one thing I'm seeing, and I guess we'll see more of, and it's a little troubling from our business standpoint, though, is data. People, I think we're seeing some shifting from doing primary research to mining these wonderful, huge databases. And now we have AI, or we had it, but now everybody knows about it, AI to help sift through that.
Right.
And pharma in particular, they have a lot of who's prescribed what all that data to do stuff with. And I think that's a wonderful source of data. I mean, I guess a couple things is that's the what. People still need the why, right? Because if you're developing materials or things, the what is great, but it's like, well, wait a minute, if we're going to change their perception, we need to know the why. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, from our point of view, we've actually worked with some of these companies that can mine this data, because our folks will give their consent because they know us and trust them. We treat them well and such, and nobody gets them. They'll give a consent, and then people can get all their medical records and sift through them and figure, and then they can get the best of both worlds. They can get the patient's experience, right, and opinions, and they can see, okay, here's what they've had, here's what they've been diagnosed with, here's their what they've been prescribed, you know, so they get everything. The patient doesn't remember all those details.
So
hopefully that we'll see the two sides come together. I don't want to see everything just go into the data, because we still need the why, and then people don't want to talk to patients. I don't know what I'll do, so that would not be good.
Well, I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon,
right?
So or especially with the aging population, I mean, all that kind of thing, right? So very, very interesting.
And every company in healthcare, the buzzword is patient centricity. And if you think about it, well, I hope so. They're the ones that you, patients, the ones using your product. Hope you, but they hadn't, for years, they hadn't been at the center. The physician was at the center because they prescribed. And then,
absolutely.
But now it's like the patients, they're more empowered. There's information, there's advertising to them that they realize that. And it's just good business. Figure out what the patients want, you know, so not just what the physicians want to give them.
Yeah, definitely. And certainly patients, I think, have more choice now than they used to. If you don't like the care that you're getting, you know, you're oftentimes you're not completely, you know, stuck with a provider.
Right. And
treatment.
And people have learned over the years, right? Not just to, it used to be, oh, the doctor is God and he'll do whatever he or she says. And now it's like, well, I'm getting another opinion, you know?
Yeah, totally. Totally, myself included. So cool.
Good.
All right.
You got to fight for your health care, because nobody else will. So.
Absolutely true. Definitely. Cool. Okay, so this is a podcast. It's media, right? I'm curious to know what media you turn to. And this is a big, broad question. It can be, you know, insight, inspiration, even just pure enjoyment. So what media is capturing your attention?
Yeah, I think I really, I'll look from time to time at like business books, but I really don't enjoy them. I like to just read, you know what I like to, this is old school, talk about old school media, or like reading books, whether it be on an iPad or like printed page.
Sure.
I like to read biographies or history.
Yeah.
And I like to think I can learn as much from that as anything. How did this guy, you know, how did Churchill win the war? Or I was just, you know, I just read, I think he's a lesser known founding father, Thomas Paine, right? He wrote Common Sense and People, and boy, the trials and tribulations of his life. But that got me interested in the French Revolution, because he was over there as part of that too. And I had a book I had started 30 years ago, I never finished, and now I'm picking it up and starting it all over. So I love to read that in terms of, that's my enjoyment, right? Every night, of course, it puts me to sleep reading, but I get a few pages in before I nod off. and do that. In terms of other stuff, you know what I've done the last couple of years? I finally got this. You have Sirius, the Sirius XM, you know, in the car. I finally got that.
Oh, you did.
And I, you know what? I pretty much listen to all the time. It's older than I am, but it's Sinatra channel. Seriously, Sinatra. So
yeah,
I got real into, and it's not just Sinatra. It's all the standards and things like that. So I've really gotten into that. And so that's what I'm more into the enjoyment than the edification, I guess. But you can learn from all these things.
Yeah, I am a big fan of the Sinatra and big band eras, for sure. So yeah, I can get behind that, Wes.
All right.
Okay, so that brings us to the most important question, the one that, of course, I really want to know. And I'm really curious about this. So, Wes, you're stranded on a desert island, right? You have three records of your choosing, albums, right? If you want to use old parlance or whatever, three albums. You're choosing to keep you company for the end of your days. What are those?
Yeah, that's tough, right? Because when you turn on these things or you turn on YouTube, it constantly pulls a million things in, right?
Yeah, everything is a mixtape nowadays.
Exactly.
What you got on your list, Wes?
Well, you know, what I like to do is get more for my money. So everything I picked, it's like a twofer.
Yeah.
So let me talk Sinatra. So I had to pick a Sinatra because a few years ago I wouldn't have said it, but now I'm thinking I'm running Sinatra. But Sinatra did at least one album with Count Basie. And I love that. Who doesn't like Count Basie in the big band? So I picked that, and it's got the old standards. That's the twofer, Sinatra with Count Basie. I mean,
very nice.
Let's do that over and over again. Another thing I love piano. I try to play it a little bit. And I love Mozart. I love the Mozart piano concertos. But to get my twofer in here, this is kind of neat. My dad was a teacher and then a principal and such. And the first job he had, he taught phys ed in a private school, Friends Select in Philly. And two of his students became famous pianists. And I remember him mentioning this because they couldn't just have him play volleyball because they break their fingers. Andre Watts was one and Peter Serkin was another. They were and they both passed away in the last few years. And I remember, but so I'll pick Peter Serkin playing the Mozart piano concerto. So,
very nice.
So it's a double. It's an honor to my dad and the piano and Mozart all. You know, that's a threefer, I guess. So
yeah, I love that.
And then the next one, I a lot of different ways I could go, but I love Gershwin, George Howard Gershwin, all their tunes. And so Ella Fitzgerald singing the Gershwin songbook. So I love all those things.
Yeah.
Who better? You got Sinatra on the one hand, but Ella Fitzgerald, you know, female vocalist. So I can't, you know, how can you get tired of that?
Yeah, I love that. I am a big fan of Ella Fitzgerald and Frank Sinatra, so I love your choices. For sure. I thought for sure you were going to say Slayer. You didn't.
Well,
you didn't,
just didn't quite make the cut. So. I don't even know what it is.
All right. Excellent. Well, I'm looking forward to your next video and what song might be your inspiration for whatever that may be. So I have subscribed to your YouTube channel because I'm waiting for it to pop up. So look for that.
I did one recently. I haven't put it out yet. It's done to a tune that all baby boomers will remember, but I don't know if everybody else will.
Okay. Are you going to tell us what it is, or we've got to wait with pins?
You want me to, what was the, anyway, the Beverly Hillbillies, the theme of the Beverly
Hillbillies. Oh, yes. Yes.
Who doesn't know that, right?
So, I'm here for it, Wes. I'm here for it for sure.
So look to that. That's the Rare Patient Voice take on the Jed Clampett. So.
Excellent. Excellent. I can't wait. Thanks so much, Wes. We'll stay in touch. Talk soon. Rock and roll.
All right.